On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, Diana Weeks from the newsroom joins us to talk about all kinds of stuff that's going on in the world, including a very personal story that she has that she's been dealing with through the entirety of the pandemic. It's personal, but it's also uplifting, and it's something that I think is going to be something many people can identify with themselves. We'll talk about a lot of stuff, including that. Stick with us.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
We had Diana Weeks on to do this, I don't know how long ago it was, a long time ago.
Yeah.
And it's been a long time since she was back, but Diana Weeks from the 900 CHML newsroom, welcome back. Thanks for doing this again.
Oh, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
It's Friday night. It's Friday night. Maybe it should be Diana Weekend.
Well, that's a dad joke you got there, Scott.
Yeah. You know, they pop out occasionally. I am a dad, so, you know, it's a occupational hazard. You know what? Happy anniversary, by the way, too.
Oh, thank you. Are you talking, which anniversary are you talking about here?
Well, today is the 2-year anniversary to the day of the World Health Organization declaring this a global pandemic.
Oh, yes.
I don't know how you celebrate that one. Why? Was there another anniversary? I didn't know.
No, I wasn't aware either. I was like, I didn't start working here in March? Or like,
so. You didn't forget your anniversary and go, oh, no,
I
said it on the air. And my wife and I have both, thankfully, on the same year. We were at my son's baseball tournament. We were out of town. We both forgot our anniversary the same day. It was the only time. But at least not one of us did it. It was both, so we could both get off the hook.
Yeah, anyway. That's okay then.
So let me ask you, for an anniversary of COVID question, and again, I have no idea how you celebrate the anniversary of COVID. We know all the bad things that have happened and all the things that we wish we had never had to go through for this. But you know what? I have to believe, and I'm not just trying to be a cockeyed optimist, I have to believe that in every situation like this, there is something that has worked out, or that you've discovered about yourself, or that you've had to change your life, or something that has been good that has come out of this. Is there something that Diana Weeks can think of that has actually, that you have benefited from or found out or learned or anything? Is there something good about COVID?
I like that take. I really do, because I'm an optimist too. And I'm going to say that one of the things that I took away was, now when I go to a live event, be it a concert or a sporting event or anything, I don't take it for granted. I look around and I'm really present and I'm like, oh my God, this is awesome. We're all together enjoying this event, whatever it may be. And I think COVID's really taught us to not take those things for granted as we used to, you know, just having that mass of people in one place.
Yeah, no, that is for sure. I mean, this weekend with the outdoor game, I mean, down at Tim Hortons Field with the Leafs and Sabres, it'll be a perfect example. We had the Grey Cup.
Yeah.
That was, you know, like all these things. So absolutely, great, great one on there. I'll tell you, one of the things, and I think a lot of people, and this sounds like it's insulting to you and others at, you know, wherever, it's not. I have learned that I love working from home. And I bet an awful lot of people are also saying the same thing. That the opportunity, and we won't always be doing it all the time, but that we learned on the fly that we can do it thanks to technology. And, you know, it is so convenient now to roll out of bed and just get right to work. No travel, no work making your lunch, no doing your hair. Not that I have that problem, but it's so easy and it makes life so much easier. Not for you, you have to be in there, but for everyone else.
Yeah. And I mean, I did have a few weeks there where, you know, obviously I tested positive for COVID, so I was working from home. And I was like, wow, this is lovely. You know, I don't have to put on any clothes. I can leave my pajamas on and work here, you know, with the cats and all that. But I think I'm the type of person that might need to go in and be more social, even if it is just one or two people.
Strokes, right?
Yeah.
It's true, though. I mean, and the idea here, and that's what I said, I don't think we're going to, you know what? I don't know if we're all those who love it going to be staying at home, but just the idea that we now have this as a possibility, the idea that, you know, if you're sick now, well, you know what? Or if you're not feeling, or if it's a huge snow day, or your kid is sick, or whatever else, you can stay home and you can still be productive because the technology that we have and we've learned that we have is amazing. I mean, who knew about Zoom before COVID?
Right. Yeah.
Or Microsoft Office, or is that the one? Anyway,
Teams.
All these things. Who
Microsoft
knew?
Teams.
Thank you. Yes. Yes, that's the one. But who knew?
Yeah. And with the price of gas right now, I mean, who really wants to drive to the office, right?
That is a whole other, I can't even imagine. One of these days, maybe tonight after the show, because it's the anniversary, maybe tonight is the night I'm going to sit down and do the math and figure out how much I've saved in gas.
That would be good.
It's astonishing. It is astonishing. And that was before gas cost you a liver and three other internal organs to, you know, to pay for the fill up. Anyway, it is, look, we're going to take a break, but while we're off, while we're away at commercial, everyone out there, think about it, find something, think of something that was positive out of COVID 2 years in. There's got to be something that with all the misery and gloom, and there's got to be something that worked out for you in this time. We'll, you know, try to be optimistic today.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Diana, you in the news leading up to this show have been talking about what happened in Hamilton in the courthouse today with the sentencing in the Devin Selvey case, second degree murder. People know about that. It's a horrendous tragedy. It's a just a the whole thing is, you know, is just painful and a blight on the city and all that kind of stuff. And well, leaving the courtroom today, unsurprisingly, Devin's mother and many of the supporters were very upset with the sentence, which was 4 years in custody for the 16-year-old who did it, but only two more because two have already been served.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people probably share that view that, you know what, a 15 or 16-year-old shoplifting a chocolate bar probably should not lead to you having the weight of the law crash down on your head because, you know, you could have been pushed into it by peer pressure or whatever else. But, you know, when you're stabbing somebody, everybody knows, unless you're an identified psychopath by some psychiatrist who's found this out, you know that that's not right. You know that's wrong. And I look at this and I share some of their views that, you know, we may want to go and relook at this young youthful offenders act, whatever it's called, youth justice offender, whatever it's called, and say, you know, for those particular crimes where it's at the extreme end, maybe this is too light. What do you think?
You know, it's so tough when they're this young, like both the victim and, you know, the one that's been convicted. I mean, it's really, really sad. I think I'm going to say it on both sides. I really do. I mean, this I feel like this never had to happen. And I mean, I just feel so sorry for Selvey's family. I really do. I mean, I feel like if I was in that position, I would probably be calling for the same thing for the Youth Criminal Justice Act, you know, to maybe not be as lenient, which is, I think, exactly what, you know, the Selvey family was saying today. And I just can't imagine that. And, you know, compounding that as well is just that... you know, now that this case is closed, like we got to remember, you know, that this happened and, you know, it happened at a school and look how young these kids were.
Yeah. And again, like I really do understand the purpose of the act of the rule, because as I said, for a lot of things, you don't want to burden a child with something for the rest of their life for a bit of stupid behavior that, you know, maybe they didn't fully grasp or, you know, it was, as I say, egged on by their friends or whatever else. But look, if everybody knows, as I say, Diana, unless you have been diagnosed with a psychopathy or something, everybody knows that stabbing someone and leaving them for dead is wrong. Everybody knows that. And I know that the sentencing today, they talked about the many challenges that the convicted killer has had in his life. Yeah. And I do have sympathy for that. But somehow 4 years for a life, just it seems way too lenient to me. It just seems way too lenient.
Yeah.
And that's what the judge had to work with.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, yeah, and I was reading the same thing that you were listening to as well. And it is quite heartbreaking to hear, you know, what the teen had gone through, you know, the one that's been sentenced. And, you know, but again, like you said, there comes a point where you ultimately know that, you know, stabbing someone is not the right thing to do. And unfortunately, it led to the death of this child. And, you know, and now, like you said, he's going to be, you know, out in no time, really. And it's just sad.
Do you think that if a government, of whether it's the current government or any other future government, came forward with a proposal to stiffen the penalties at the extreme end, so what we're talking about here, murder or that kind of thing, do you think that that would find popular support within the country? Because I really believe it would.
I think it would, but then also, I mean, and I'm sure you've read a lot about this too, and just done some research, you know, on punishment as opposed to, you know, like recuperating someone and kind of like, you know, helping them out. And I mean, there's a lot of studies that say, you know, if the sentence is less harsh and you try to help these people, then the chance of reoffending isn't that bad, and it's better for the, you know, the correction system. But I mean, I just don't know how, you know, where you draw the line and how you know someone will be able to, you know, not do it again, or if someone will be able to respond well to, you know, being helped or that kind of thing.
Because if I recall correctly, and somebody can write in and tell me that I'm totally wrong on this one, if there's a lawyer listening, but I believe that if what is on your file, what is on your record as a youth, essentially doesn't carry forward. So if this person was to do something else down the road, even though they've got this is not something that carries on. I look at this, and it's, as you just said, and you said it bang on correct. It was unnecessary. It didn't have to happen. It was totally senseless. And it's such a tragedy, not just for the family, although certainly for them, but for this community. And it just seems like such an unimpressive, and that's probably a wrong word, but an unimpressive sentence that just, and I know you're right about rehabilitation and trying to help people and correct their life and make them not do this again. But boy, there has to be some sort of punitive part to killing someone, doesn't there? There has to be.
Yeah, for sure. I agree. I mean, because then what message does it really send to others out there, you know, that maybe have more callous thoughts and think like, you know, they're bullying someone, and unfortunately, you know, it escalates to this, because when you're a kid, I don't think you think of consequences, and you know, this isn't making it any easier in terms of, you know, being like, well, I'll get off on it anyways, like, so I mean, it's just, it's a tricky one.
It is very difficult. And as I say, I mean, look, when I was a kid, never did this, but I mean, look, we've all done, I know when I was a kid, did some stuff that was really stupid because you don't think through, as you say, the consequences. But even when I was 11 or 12 or 13 or 14, if you had asked me, I would have known that there is some things that you just cannot do, that you're not allowed to do, that you don't hurt other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, so, you know, shoplifting or I don't know, doing something that would damage property or something. I never did a lot of that stuff. I mean, my stuff was always really stupid, but nonetheless, I think that there can be a blurry line for a lot of kids, but that blurry line ends at a certain point. And I think we should look at whether or not we say where that line ends, we're going to treat you with a little more oomph. That's what I thought today when I saw this. I feel terrible for the family. In fact, I feel terrible for the, you know, for both families, not to the same degree, obviously, for the kid. I mean, look, the kid who did this, I don't carry a huge amount of sympathy, but they do have, this child, this person did have challenges. But you know what? With that degree of sympathy for the difficult things he went through, you still can't do this. And I just can't believe that he didn't know that.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
This was a story that got a lot of attention in the last day or two. Let me just read the first couple sentences from this Reuters piece. Meta platforms, which is Facebook, will allow Facebook and Instagram users in some countries to call for violence against Russians and Russian soldiers in the context of the Ukraine invasion, according to internal emails seen by Reuters on Thursday, in a temporary change to its hate speech policy. The social media company is also temporarily allowing some posts that call for death to Russian President Vladimir Putin or Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, according to internal emails to its content moderators. What do you think about the idea of a social media company saying, you know what, if you are in one of these countries and you are under siege by the Russian government, you're going to be allowed to say, I hope someone shoots Vladimir Putin, or I hope that we wipe out all the Russian soldiers, or something to that effect. What do you think?
Well, it's definitely very, very tricky ground to start. Like, this is going to, I'm not quite sure what kind of precedent this is going to set. And mainly that's what, you know, what the main thing of this whole issue is. And I think a lot of people share the sentiment that, you know, that maybe something needs to be done with Putin and, you know, something needs to happen. However, I don't think that this particular way of going about it is necessarily the smartest.
No, and I think you're bang on. I think the precedent issue here, look, we've had issues already with Facebook or with Twitter, with other Instagram things. For example, a perfect example was a number of months ago, there was a hack of a computer program in which the son of the current president of the United States was caught up in this information about a hack. And Twitter says, we do not allow on our platform hacked material that was illegally gained. And yet we just had, here in Canada, we had a hack of those who had donated money to the Freedom Convoy. And there was lots of stuff put on Twitter about those people. And it just seems like, you know, it's already difficult enough to try to be consistent. And now you're allowing this. And look, I'm close to a free speech absolutist. I would prefer that we be allowed to have free speech and, you know, whatever. But I don't know how you put Pandora back in the box after this.
That's what I'm worried about. I mean, if someone in Ukraine wants to say death to Putin on Instagram or Facebook, I really think that they should be allowed because of what is happening. However, after this ends, and hopefully it will end soon, what happens? Like, and at what point, like, are we going to show violent images? Are we going to, you know, is it going to be a call to arms? Like, what is it going to do? And what, you know, are other places going to be like, well, why aren't you allowing us to do this and call for this tyrant to be killed? And exactly. I just feel like it's, like you said, a Pandora's box of, I don't know.
No, Ukraine is not the only place in the world where there is war going on now or in the past or will be in the future. And so, you know, we've heard a lot in recent days about people saying, well, what's going to happen with Taiwan? Is China looking at what's happening here and seeing how the world responds?
Yeah.
Is this going to be allowed to be done then if China was to do something? Or what about in some African countries where there are civil wars going on? Or like, where's the line? How do you either say we're opening Facebook and you can say whatever the heck you want.
Yeah.
Or you say, we're blocking all violent content, regardless of the circumstance. I don't know how you find this nuance.
The only thing that I can think of that would be good that would come out of this is perhaps Meta is taking this opportunity to, instead of chasing down all these threats toward Putin and death wishes on him, there may be targeting what's really the issue, and that's the spread of propaganda on these channels. And I hope that the people that are employed at Meta are doing more of that, and you know, getting rid of the misinformation and disinformation that's really been spawned from this. Because I still see a lot of really troubling stuff out there, and I just can't believe that it's still getting put out there.
And look, the disinformation thing is clearly a real issue that we have to deal with. That said, I don't believe for a second that there is no disinformation or bad information coming out from the other side, even from the good guys, from the Ukrainian side. Look, I believe there's lots of misinformation. We've seen what is being said on Russian media. We've heard about it. But I also think there are going to be people, it's inevitable, there are going to be people on the other side who also sage stuff and spread misinformation. It seems to be a natural human condition, maybe less, but how do you, unless you are going to go through every post, and no social media organization has the ability to do that, how do you do this? I just don't know how you even begin to get into this and try and parse what's okay and what isn't.
Yeah. And I mean, and that's where I think a lot of it falls, is that, you know, a lot of people are against the quote unquote mainstream media in these days. But at the end of the day, I'd like to believe at least this organization does a fair amount of fact checking before we see anything from either side. So if there's a video that's posted showing something, we're not going to automatically run with it and be like, see, this is happening. You know, it has to be verified, third party verified. It has to be checked. It has to be, you know, corroborated. And sometimes that'll happen and I'll see a video and, you know, well, I might want to retweet it. I don't know if it's factual because it could be from 2014, you know, and so you don't know where it's coming from. And I think with social media, it's just really hard on both sides to figure out what exactly is real video or you know, real claims. And, you know, it's messy.
There was a topic that I wanted to do on the show in the last week or two. And I saw lots about it on social media, but I could not establish that the basis of it was true. There was a ton of chatter, but I couldn't know for sure. And I didn't see any other stories about it or something. And so I was like, you know what? No, I'm not going to be the one that goes down that path and ends up looking like an idiot because I've sent something out or talked about it and I find out that it was just a rumor or something.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference. And I'm not holding myself up as the beacon of greatness by any stretch, but that's the difference. So many people on social media, you see something and you and I in this business and many other people would say, I know that's not true, but they post it thinking it is.
Yeah.
And it just gets passed along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
Again, though, we come back to this thing. I don't know how, let's go back to Pandora, because I don't know how when this war is over, I don't know how you undo this. Where is the line? And we were talking about a line. Here we are talking about another line. Where's the line? Like, Putin is obviously really bad and doing something really evil, mm-hmm. but there's lots of other leaders that are doing bad things and evil things. Where's the line?
Yeah, that's the thing is that, you know, like you said, there's the war that's going on right now in Ukraine is absolutely terrible. However, there are other wars that are still being waged. And I mean, are we going to open it up to, you know, the people that are oppressing those nations? And I just, I mean, it's really tough to decide on this.
You know, the other part about this, and this is where I think Facebook and others, I mean, Facebook is the one who we're talking about because the story is out about them making this decision. But I think a lot of these social media giants have gotten themselves into a bit of a bind because they've decided they want to be controlling the information as opposed to simply being a conduit for the information. And I understand that simply being a conduit, you could open yourself up to people saying all kinds of wacky things, but I don't know how, with Twitter or Facebook being so massive, I don't know how you possibly think you can stop all this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, this is scary stuff, right? Because we know the amount of propaganda that's coming out of Russia, right? We know it. And if you look back at like what happened during World War II, can you imagine if they had Twitter or Facebook during that time to disseminate that information? Like, it would be horrendous. And I think that's where we're at right now, is that this dictator essentially is sending this propaganda out. And unfortunately, there is some people that are believing in it and putting it out there on social media. And so it's really hard to figure out, like, who's accountable. Like, is the social media platform going to be held accountable for allowing this? Like, how many people do they need to stop this? Because it is, essentially is very dangerous propaganda that is out there, right?
Well, and because you've had a policy in place and now you are softening this or allowing it, what happens if an innocent person gets killed in this conflict? I mean, innocent people are getting killed in the conflict all the time, but yep. That you could identify as someone who was targeted on a social media post. Is the social media company somehow liable? I don't know how you possibly would, mm-hmm. but would blood be on their hands if someone said that person has to be killed and it turns out that person wasn't doing anything wrong? I just don't know how you know, you said about World War II, like, it's a different thing, but I mean, in World War II, the Germans were working on the Enigma machine and used the, I mean, mm-hmm. way back then, it wasn't really propaganda, but it was secrets. It was kind of like that. You're right. Imagine if they had the social media technology that we have today back then, how that would have been utilized.
Yeah, well, I mean,
crazy.
I mean, comparisons have been drawn, but basically, you know, is Putin, you know, comparable to Hitler? Absolutely, of course he is. So can you imagine if Hitler was having access to this kind of social media network and how the propaganda machine would have spread? Like, it's just unreal. And I think that I really think that Facebook, you know, it's, how are they going to be held accountable for certain things? You're right. Like, I mean, is blood going to be on their hands if, let's say, someone innocent gets killed? And it's just really, really tough.
Yeah, you almost, to me, and we got to run, to me, you almost have to say, we are letting it be all out there, and this is just a bulletin board where you can post anything and everyone can sort through what you believe or not. Or you put yourself in a position where you are going to have to do something that I don't know that you can do, because there's going to be flaws and openings and leaks, and mm-hmm. I don't know how you get around that.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Do you believe that it is important still for students in school to learn cursive writing, or are we past the point where we need cursive writing because we have computers and we can type and we have tablets and laptops, and who needs cursive writing, and why do we need to tie up our time with that? What are you, where are you on that one?
I love stationery and I love handwritten notes and cards and all those things. So I'm going to be a little biased here and say I really do appreciate the art of writing, but maybe it should be more of an art and go in kind of that realm, because I do agree. And I think that in this day and age, it is possibly a little outdated. And I think that what we need to focus on more is maybe, you know, grammar, spelling, punctuation, that kind of thing for kids, because, you know, the spell check and everything and everything being done for them online, like it doesn't, it's not translating as well to them.
Oh,
so.
So first of all, yes, kudos to you on that point, because as a grammar nerd, and I apologize, I'm one of those
Me
people,
too.
I got to tell you, the seeing people writing today, and I think it comes from a lot of their social media, we're just talking about social media, it is unbelievable how bad, not just kids are, how bad people are at grammar.
Oh, yeah,
these
adults.
Days.
It's atrocious. Yeah.
It's you know, some people are going to say, well, who cares? As long as you can get your point across, who cares if you're doing it in the Queen's English?
No.
I think it matters.
It does.
I still do. I think communicating properly matters.
Yes. I agree.
All right. So here's why I asked about cursive. There is a story that I read, and I mean, this is an all-time great story. Unless you're the person involved in it. There was a woman who, doctors traditionally have written prescriptions in handwriting in cursive that is just one step ahead of what a chicken would do if you put ink on its talons and scratch it on a page. And this woman, the pharmacist could not properly read the doctor's handwriting, which, you know, again, is a common problem. The woman was supposed to be getting an eye ointment,
dear.
The pharmacist mistakenly dispensed a rousing rub that was supposed to be for another area of a male physique.
Oh, dear Lord. Wow. Okay.
And so when I heard this, I said, okay, you know, I was of the opinion that cursive needed to be taught. And now I'm really of the opinion that cursive needs to be taught, because even if we're not going to be doctors making prescriptions, I do think the ability to write down our thoughts and our words and not have a computer handy, and do it in a way that's somewhat legible, I really do think
that's important.
Go back in history, in all of history, we've been able to communicate without technology.
Yeah. I think if we lose that, it's just a sleigh ride into whatever's coming next that's not good, you know? Like, if we lose the ability to read and write with our bare hands, you know, and rely on computers, I don't think that's the way we got to go.
I'm with you. And why, I mean, this is something that maybe it seems old-fashioned. Maybe that's why we're not as enthusiastic about it, because it just seems very old-fashioned now. But some old things are okay.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, I don't know that we have to dump everything just because we have a technology that usurps it now.
No, absolutely not. Like I said, I still love sending actual cards and snail mail. I do. I really like it. I love it. I know a lot of people are like, why are you sending cards? You could just send an e-bite or send them a Christmas card. I love doing the Christmas cards and I love sending them out. I love getting them. And you know, just mail in general. You know, we don't do that anymore. Like, it's sad, actually.
There is, and someone's handwriting, and like, I don't know if you have good handwriting or poor handwriting. I don't know if you have, I mean, by the sounds of it, you probably have very lovely handwriting if you like doing this still. But it almost doesn't matter, because there is something very personal about getting something in someone's hand that you don't get if you just get an email.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, my mom and I went to an antique store a while ago. It was a few months ago, and they had a huge bin of all these old postcards. Like, some of them were dating back to, like, you know, the late 1800s, early 1900s, and it was just beautiful seeing these, you know, whether or not the penmanship was good. It was just something that was so special, you know, having this handwritten notes, and it's just not the same, I feel.
Have you ever seen any of those pictures or whatever of the letters home from the war, the soldiers on the battlefield?
Yes.
And you know what? If they had pecked those out on an iPhone, it would have not been anywhere near as striking and personal and whatever else, that whatever word you want to use, as seeing it in their handwriting with a little pencil they were carrying around somewhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. Agree.
You know, and not to get personal or maudlin or sad or anything, but I'm doing the show from home today, and behind me on the wall, I have a letter that my father wrote to me. My father passed away in June. My father wrote to me that was to be given to me after he died. He had written it a couple of years ago. And again, that is something that his handwriting was awful. My dad could have been a doctor with his handwriting, writing bad prescriptions, but it doesn't matter because it's just if that was just a typed out note, it would be still meaningful. But when I turn around and look, it would just look like any of the other emails or notes that we get every single day.
Yeah, that's right. That's beautiful that you have that. I you know, that's something that I think, yeah, we really need to cherish for sure.
I don't know. I just, the idea of us just dumping all this stuff, not just because some poor woman with dry eyes ended up rubbing a
special medication. I'm going to let medication. You finish this.
Yeah, a special medication on her eyes. That's I am curious. The story is not about that. But I am curious what happened to her eyes.
Yeah, like
It could have been. Well, we'll leave it to everyone's imagination what happened to their eyes.
Probably for the best.
Very much for the best, Diana.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Now, I want to get into something, and this is a personal thing. And Diana, I mean, look, for people to understand this, this is not something that we would have been chatting about under normal circumstances. This is something that if you had confided in people in the newsroom about what you've been going through, this is not something we would have immediately run to the microphone and talked about. However, you very publicly, very bravely have written a piece in Today's Parent about a struggle that you've been going through, you and your husband have been going through COVID. And it's not just about you, although it's very personal in this particular story, but I think it speaks to an awful lot of the challenges that a lot of people have had through the last 2 years with not being able to, for loved ones to get in for doctor's appointments or for how we do doctor's appointments and how this and that was done. Why don't you take it for a minute or two here? Tell us the story that you wrote about and what you wrote about in this magazine.
Okay, so my story is about the infertility journey that my husband and I have both been on, which started at around the time when, you know, it was almost 2 years. It was, I guess, pretty much 2 years to today. And, you know, it had been going on for a little bit before March 2020. But essentially, we started seeing a fertility specialist in March 2020. And that's where we really got the ball rolling. So what I wrote about was just that, you know, obviously, a lot of people go through IVF, a lot of people go through infertility. And like you said, this is something that is not necessarily specific to the infertility community, but it could be anyone that's been suffering from any illness or isolation during the pandemic. But my angle on it was that, you know, this journey that we were on was already incredibly isolating. And the COVID pandemic just exacerbated it in the sense that, you know, there wasn't really anything we could do to distract ourselves from it. So it almost became like an obsession and almost like our hobby. Like, we can't fly away for a weekend to go, you know, escape this. We can't go visit friends. We just have to sit here and, you know, twiddle our thumbs while we wait for results to come in or while we wait for the next round of IVF. And so that was really hard. And that coupled with the fact that, you know, my doctors and nurses, I mean, you see masks in the medical community all the time, but I literally was sitting in a room with the same nurse for over a year and I never saw her face. I just saw her eyes. And it was like, it's weird. It was weird to me.
There is a lot of stuff in this that I want to talk about. And, you know, if people are a little uncomfortable, I think that's okay. I think uncomfortable can be okay when we're talking about something like this. And again, maybe part of why this is so interesting is this is not something that you normally would. When you say how isolated you were, this is not necessarily something that you talk about with people anyway, because it's a very private thing that you're going through. But there might have been a friend or someone else. It becomes, as you say, even more isolating because it's really just the two of you. There's nobody around to talk about this with.
Yeah. And I mean, at the beginning of it, it was more like halfway through, I decided that, you know, I was on the infertility community is huge on social media and they're very supportive. Like, I've made so many friends, like in Tucson, Arizona, in New York City, in Australia, like women around the globe. And I was just kind of in the background, like talking to them in DMs and whatnot. And then I thought, you know what, I'm going to you know, if you go on Instagram, you look this up, there are so many accounts of women who are documenting their infertility journeys. And for me, this was a savior because I was like, you know, am I injecting myself with my medication right? Like, okay, let me go check this girl's Instagram, or like, let me go do that. And it almost lightened it a bit. And so I joined that community and I was posting for a while about my journey. But when it started to kind of become like comparing my journey to another woman's journey on social media, it wasn't really serving me anymore. I was like, I don't think this is helping me. And so then we brought it back to just being private.
And see, that's really interesting because a lot of people say, you know, if they have cancer or if they have whatever else, just talking with people who have the same thing is very comforting. And I've always thought I could see that in some ways that would be very comforting. On the other hand, I could see that it could also be very devastating.
Yeah.
You know, because there's two sides to that story. You can have the wild, amazing success stories, or you can have the truly devastating outcomes. And if you're on the wrong page, if you're talking to the wrong person, that could be crushing.
Yeah. And essentially that's what was happening was that that's what social media does, right? You compare, oh, why is this person doing this? Or why is this person here? Why am I not doing this? And so a lot of it became like, well, you know, I didn't have that result with my IVF, you know, what was wrong with me? And so you go down this rabbit hole and it's just too much information. And it's also just it became too much of like women just obsessing over their fertility journey. And at the end of the day, and what I wrote is that I've kind of come full circle where I don't know what our next steps are going to be, but like, I know that I couldn't go on like that. Like, there's no way. Like, I completely forgot, and I said in the article as well, like, who I am. Like, I have a career, I have a husband, I have a loving family, I have tons of friends, and that kind of like, I forgot about all that and was just like, baby, baby, baby. And I just, that's not healthy, right, for anything. So yeah.
There's another part of this, and I'll get back to that in a second, but there's another part of this that I think, even if someone is certainly not going through the same thing you are, I don't know what the percentage is of people in Canada who over the last 2 years have either themselves or with someone else in their family had to have some sort of medical treatment, had to go to hospital or go to a doctor. I bet the number is enormous. If you're talking about immediate family, the number of people who in their immediate family, somebody had to go to a doctor for something. And as you point out here, even with your husband, most of the time he couldn't even go into these visits with you.
No.
And that's a very common thing, I would think. Someone goes into a doctor for a diagnosis or for a treatment or for a this, or people died in hospital without their families there.
Yeah.
That would be really difficult.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this obviously pales in comparison to someone who's,
going through
chemotherapy or needing to, you know, but it is in a sense, it was very isolating. Like, you know, we came to terms a long time ago that it likely wouldn't be, you know, a romantic evening where, you know, we'd create our child. But other women before COVID had been able to bring their husband in. And actually, it was pretty cool. Like, science is pretty cool. And you get to see your embryos, you know, on the screen there. And I was by myself. And I was like, well, this is kind of cool. Wish my husband was here, you know? So it was sad.
Well, it's sad. And you also write, and this is something else that I think is really applicable to an awful lot of people. And you say, you know, like, who am I to complain? And, you know, especially in the middle of a pandemic, because everybody's got stuff,
yeah,
right? I mean, like the world, everybody's got something that, and so probably you're thinking, and again, I mean, every family has had, or many, a situation of someone going through something. Do you know, I don't want to bother them with this because they've got their own stuff going on.
Yeah.
And so you end up more holding everything to yourself.
Yeah. And I think there's also that guilt too. And especially because my article just recently came out. I mean, it came out the day after Russia invaded Ukraine. And I felt myself being like, oh, geez, like, I know that this was sad for me, but like, there's like children dying now. And like, is my journey, like, it doesn't even compare to this. But I think we all have to honor the fact that we all have separate traumas and separate things. And I don't think they're any less traumatic, or we shouldn't have to feel guilty, I don't think, because we all do different things and have different experiences, and it's all relevant and important.
Well, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, what's happening in Ukraine and what's happening to people there is horrendous. And I do think it's a valuable thing for us not to be sulking and moping about every little thing that's going on when you compare it in the world. But by the same token, I mean, this is something that is deeply important to you, and other people who have issues, they are deeply important to them. I don't think that it's also healthy just to say, well, I'm not in the worst position of anybody on planet Earth, therefore I must not worry about this.
That's right. And I mean, that's something that we've been dealing with forever, right? There's always going to be people that are in a much worse position.
What's been the response to this?
It's been very, very good. I mean, the response in the workplace, first of all, has been amazing. Like Rick, Shona, Paul, Lisa, Dave, like everyone has just been amazing. That has they've known about it for a while. And even Jeff, like our boss Jeff. And they've just been, I could never imagine that coworkers could be so understanding and accommodating. You know, just asking me how I am, how I'm doing, and so when I wrote the article, you know, they obviously knew it was bad, but I think they really realized just maybe how much I was suffering but wasn't showing it here. And I think that that was something that maybe hit some of them a little bit, like, wow, like, you know, so, but.
And I think there's, and again, I mean, different things. Not everyone is going to be dealing with infertility or cancer or whatever. But I think there's an awful lot of people that coming out of COVID, I think one of the real things that we're, I mean, 2-year anniversary today, as we've said, one of the real things we're going to find that we're dealing with is an awful lot of people have had stuff that they haven't really talked about or dealt with really, because again, it's who am I to complain?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who am I to complain? So I've just kept it all to myself. And now, you know, there's other stuff going on.
Yeah, for sure.
It was, it's a piece that people should read. It's in today's Parent. They can find it online. I'm looking at the screen right now. The headline is "Nothing Prepared Me for the Immense Loneliness of Infertility During the Pandemic." It is very personal. It is very interesting. And it is, as I say, nothing prepared me for the, fit in your own word there. Probably in your life, there's some word you would put in there and think of a lot of the things. Different scenario, I understand completely from what Diana's talking about. But I think there's probably an awful lot of people who could read this and say, you know what, that actually sounds pretty familiar. It's a pretty universal thing, I think, Diana. All right, let us, so we only have a couple minutes left here. So let me, there is no easy segue from that to the
Don't worry, you go for it. You do what you need to do. I got a good sense of humor.
I was trying to think, okay, how do I move from one to the other on this, from this to anything? So, you know, let us finish with something that is, you know, really unimportant, although in its complete unimportance has caused some people to go absolutely crazy about this. And that is this story that the Academy Awards are saying we're cutting down the number of awards we're going to show when we have our presentation because, you know, people are tuning out when we get to the best Oscar for third assistant director in makeup performance, right? And so they're cutting, I think it's 8 categories out, going to show them in like a rapid fire highlight moment on the show. But many of the people in Hollywood have just lost it over this. That how can you possibly do this? Do you watch the Oscars, first of all? Do you still, as a rule, watch the Oscars?
I do, but I'm one of those people that probably turn it off, like, after, you know, Best Picture has been announced and all that kind of stuff. And I do, but I often find that I don't watch all the movies or any of them that are up for Oscars.
Yes.
I don't even know who's nominated this year. Really, I don't. So
I'm with you. That's been a huge problem that lately... Not only do the awards run forever, but lately, you're right, it seems that there's so many movies that get nominated that nobody has seen.
Yeah.
Like, whatever happened to the year when Titanic had 400 nominations, but everybody in the world had seen Titanic, so at least you were like, okay, I have some idea of what I'm rooting for or what I'm watching here.
Yeah. It just started to become really obscure. I was like, have you seen this? No, I haven't seen it. And I'm like, well, where did this movie come from? You know?
100%. And I know that now we're getting a little more of it where they're on Netflix. So maybe there's going to be some broader base on this. But, you know, a 3.5 or 4 hour show celebrating a bunch of stuff nobody has seen, featuring a number of backroom people that no one's ever heard of, thanking a whole bunch of agents and other people that no one will ever hear again. I can't, considering these are the people who make the best entertainment in the world, I can't imagine how they got to this point with this show.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, should the Oscars, when you put together in the room all the brightest lights in entertainment, should this not be the best show on television every single year?
Yeah, you'd think so. I mean, you look at the Grammys, and I guess that's a little different because they're able to have, like, you know, the singers perform and do all that stuff. So it's more interactive, more entertaining. I think they got to do more of that. Like, more, get the artists, you know, that are doing the songs for the movies, get them in there, get them out there, do some reenactments, like, you know, make it more than just, and the award goes to, and the award goes to. And
yeah. What if you made a rule that said, and I know that, you know, if Hollywood is freaking out by cutting out a number of obscure categories, what if you put in a rule that says you are not permitted to thank anyone?
Oh, wow.
And you can go up and give your 30-second speech or whatever about some political cause you have if you want to alienate half the country or whatever else, but you cannot just get up there and rhyme off a list of people. And if you made it a rule, then those people wouldn't be offended because you haven't left them out. You don't have a choice.
And that would cut a lot of time, yeah.
It would cut time. It would give them a chance to do some of the stuff you're talking about that is actually interesting. I don't know. I considering how many people once upon a time watched this show, and I got to think that George Smithers, who was my agent's assistant, who got thanked, you've got 40 million people and you're taking time for only one person to hear his name. It seems not right.
No, I don't think, yeah.
I don't know what they can do to salvage this. I don't know if this is going to do it or not. I think that, I don't know. You know what? In the modern world of movies, what might be the answer to this, Diana? And maybe I'm missing the point because they're going to lose out on money. If for 1 week leading up to the Academy Awards, if they required all the nominated movies to be put onto a streaming service.
That would be a fantastic idea. I have no idea how the logistics work, and that's probably a terrible idea for finances. And you and I are probably not the ones to consult on this, but I really think that I would watch them. Like, if they had like an Oscars category, and I think I've seen that before, but more so ahead of the Oscars, not after the fact.
But, you know, have the Academy Awards create their own streaming service that goes up for a 1 week period, the week before the Oscars, and all the nominated movies get thrown on there for 1 week. And even, you know what, even if it's a $10 for that year fee, so they get some money out of it.
I like that, because then, you know what, I would be inclined to watch that, and then I would be inclined to watch the awards, and I think a lot of people would, and I think the ratings and viewership would go up. That's a great idea.
You know what else they could do? And as we're solving the world's problems, you don't even have to put the full movie on there. Have like a super extended trailer where it's like a 15-minute part of the movie.
Yeah.
So you still have to then go and watch
it. Like the Coles notes.
But you get a real flavor of what it is. More than because a trailer is 1 minute or so, and it's all just the high points. It has to be a complete chunk that you've pulled out of the movie for like 15 minutes. Of what you think is the best part of the movie or whatever else. See, we can solve these problems. We could get the Oscars to be a thing again.
If they would only ask us.
Well, you know what? In time, when the numbers keep going down, eventually they'll call around asking.
That's true.
Diana Weeks, listen, it is, I love having you on here. It's been way too long since we did this. I really appreciate you sticking around. You've been at the office since 4 this morning or something.
Just 11. Okay,
well, listen, love having you on. If anyone was just trying to figure out why they knew the name Diana Weeks as we were talking about this, yes, that is, she is on CHML News every day. You hear her every day on the station here, and we were able to grab her for a few more minutes on a Friday night. Diana, thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good weekend, Scott.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.